Andy Moog joins us. Andy, welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Thank you. Good afternoon. Very well.
Hey, I appreciate you coming on. We've been talking about the 1997 Oilers Stars series for last week and this week with coaches and players, and really hearing some unique tales from both sides, Andy. You know, you're a veteran at that time, and I think you can recall, because you were a guy, if we circle back about 16 years earlier, you kind of, you know, dominated a series against the Montreal Canadiens. Kind of, you know, you're coming to on the stage as a goaltender. When you look back to your career, like, can you talk about when a goalie just gets in a zone like that and what it feels like from a goalie perspective?
Well, I suppose the first thing that you know but you don't have to think about is it's just instinctive and reactive. There's very little analysis. I would venture to say that there's almost no scouting or pre-scouting that would have affected or applied to anything you were doing out there. It was just purely instinctive, reactive athleticism. And, you know, you just keep the role going, and less thinking is better, I suppose.
Okay, that's fair. And so, you know, you'd won Stanley Cups. You know, you'd been to a lot of Stanley Cup finals with the Oilers and the Boston Bruins, and then you came to Dallas. You know, it's later in your career. That was a really veteran group in Dallas and was just kind of the start. Of course, you know, they went to the conference final the next year, then to the Stanley Cup final 2 years in a row in 99 and 2000. Did you, like, when you look back on 97, how much of a lost opportunity was that for that group, having been a guy who's won on teams? Or did that need to happen for that group to get to where they were a few years later?
There's so many examples of that team that appears to be or seems to be ready to win, but they have to lose first. And I think that was a pretty good example of that. Obviously, personnel changes occurred over the following 2 years, and you know, that pushed them over the edge. But I think that might have been an example. I mean, we did everything right in that series except score enough goals, I suppose. And, you know, that's something that you hear your whole career, these things even out. You don't want to hear that as you're in the series. You want to take advantage and try and win. But those sorts of upsets and underdog successes even out over your career, and that was just that was one that the Oilers definitely earned.
So, I guess when you say it evens out, would the 91 Montreal then be your evening out in your career?
Well, we certainly did not appear to be in a position to win that series and you know, even more importantly, sweep that series. It didn't look like it could happen. And the 90, what was it, the 91 team in Boston that was in the conference final against the Pittsburgh Penguins, I think they set a record that year, something like 380 man games. We ended up using 52 players on the regular season roster. I mean, things like that shouldn't happen, but they do. You just find a spark, find some magic, and you get through. So, I mean, that's what I mean about evening out. I had several of opportunities where I was successful, our team was successful, and we may not necessarily have deserved to be that successful.
Andy Moog joins us. And you mentioned, you know, your team didn't score many goals. We had Ken Hitchcock on, and he felt like, you know, he goes, if looking back, we let a goalie beat us in Curtis Joseph. Now, you obviously didn't, you know, you're never shooting on him or anything, but how did you see it from the other end of the ice and how Joseph played that series in 97?
Well, let's begin with Kenny Hitchcock acknowledging that the goalie had a part in the series. That's a first right there. Let's start right there. That's pretty significant. But yeah, that's what it was. I mean, our power play was as good as any's in the league that year, and we created ample enough great scoring chances, but Curtis had the answer on many of them, and he got some breaks on others, whether they were missed shots or off the post or desperate defensive plays, but our power play was exceptional. I would say that would have been enough to win a normal series, but not this one.
Andy Moog joins us. And Andy, as a goalie at the other end, and I know they always say, well, you know, I don't try to think about it. I can only focus on what I do. But when a goalie at the other end is, you know, is playing out of his mind like that, even if you don't want to, does it sneak into your mind like, man, I got to match him? Is that in your mindset? Or because you were, what, a 17-year veteran at that point,
yeah,
you know, you knew not to let that sneak in?
every minute of every game that's there. That's that's the challenge. That's the challenge. Just sort of keep it out on a the wing, or keep it out of the focus point of your brain. It's always there. It's going to be a part of your competitive nature. You want to beat that guy. And in a goaltender scenario, how are you going to beat him? Well, you're going to have to match him save for save and then some. So it's always there. You just can't let it affect your process of making saves. I suppose that's probably the best way to say it. You can't let that energy or that force affect how you go ahead and process and make saves.
Would your teammates ever, in a playoff series like that, like, would they come up to you and, hey, you know, should I shoot on him here? Do you see a weakness? Or is that stuff all done between the coaches and the offensive guys?
You know, at that time, so late 90s, it still wasn't a goaltender scouting report available to shooters. It just hadn't evolved to the state that it is now. This sort of information was passed around mouth to mouth and word of mouth in the room, and that's sort of the standard at that time, is the shooters would just share experiences and, oh, I beat him like this and I got him to move there and I got one there. And at the time that was plenty. That was ample. That was sort of the cutting edge of goaltender pre-scouting, was just word of mouth amongst the forwards and the scorers.
Interesting. Okay, so you know, it is funny how the games evolve to that, right? Where you look at tendencies to think of, you know. But sometimes when a goalie's, you know, unorthodox, maybe is not the play word. But sometimes, like, you look at the save he made on Joe Nieuwendyk. Like, there's no scouting report there, right? That's just a reaction. And Nieuwendyk, we've had him on. He said, "Man, I thought I got it." Like, sure, you wish you could get more, but it wasn't like he fluttered that one in there. That's just an effort kind of reaction save by the goalie.
Yeah, that's fair. And you know, it gets back to, you know, even in today's game, you can have all these evaluations and all these scouting analysis of goaltenders. But if you want to beat a goalie, you have to take his eyes away. And that's the bottom line. It was 20 years ago, and it's very apparent today. If you want to have success on a goalie, you have to consistently have a net presence, and you have to take the goalie's eyes away. It's a big commitment, because you go down in there as a forward, attacking forward, you're going to take a beating. But if you want to disrupt the goalie's flow and rhythm, you have to find ways to take his eyes away on a consistent basis to disrupt that rhythm or that flow that the goalie has.
Andy Moog joins us. Was Ryan Smith good at disrupting the flow?
He had a willingness to go to those areas. It wasn't malicious. I mean, he'd fall on top of you from time to time, and it'd look like an accident, and you and he both know it wasn't, but he had the ability to go into those areas, take the beating. You know, Darian Hatcher never missed a chance to pop him in the head, and he did it regularly. So, I mean, if you're willing to go there, you're probably going to get rewarded on a regular basis.
We had Smitty on earlier today, and he talked about Game 5. He said the ice might have been the worst he's ever played on for a game. It was super hot that game. That was when he went to double overtime. When the ice is that bad, how does it impact the goalie, Andy? What's the biggest challenge when the ice is that bad?
The ice gets bad? I never knew the ice got bad. That's a bunch of pissing and moaning on Smitty's part. Bad.
Okay.
Ice. Come on, you're not allowed to say that crap anymore. You can't. Well, maybe you could then, but you can't now. I know it was a little. There were enough times in reunion that it got foggy in there that it felt like it was. You know, the air temperature might have been over 80, and the ice just didn't. You know, it just didn't hold up the way you expected. You get 5 or 6 minutes of good ice every start of every period, and then it was a struggle the last 14 minutes sort of thing. So I wouldn't be surprised by that. It was just, I never really concerned myself with the ice. The temperature in the building was unbelievable. It was so warm in there, and I think that's something that, you know, we all power through. But I think in the end, the temperature in the building was the greatest obstacle to overcome.
So what did you do to try to overcome it in games? Like, you know, you're putting ice packs on your neck, at intermission. What are you doing to try to combat the heat?
Man, I saw players, I'm not exaggerating. There's players getting hooked up and doing intravenous between periods just because of the concerns for dehydration. That's That's the biggest thing. You got to hydrate. You got to do, you know, the appropriate kind of hydration. Back then, it was pretty much a straight Gatorade. I mean, there was no sophisticated hydration methods. It was just straight old Gatorade. So a lot of guys did that. Lots of water, obviously, and hydrate. And, you know, we didn't go through it alone. Let's put it that way. We knew everybody in the room was, and pretty good chance everybody in the other room was too. So it wasn't like you were going through it alone. Everybody had to deal with the same issues.
Yeah, and so that was how humid and hot it was in Dallas. And then you, of course, played a lot of your career in Edmonton, then you come back. So was that a mental challenge in the game, really? Because you go from Dallas, super hot, and you're just trying to do everything to stay hydrated. Then you come to Edmonton, and, you know, it's not nearly as hot. Like, was it easier to play the games physically in Edmonton at all because of the temperature?
Well, I know that I had... I had one standard setup for my skates, and in Dallas I would dull them down as much as I could without damaging edges. So I'd typically have a much duller blade and sort of less resistance and dig into the ice. And then in Edmonton on that firm fast ice with zero humidity, you want a little more bite in your head. So I would change my, you know, the trainers wouldn't change any hollow or anything like that, but I'd be a little sharper and a little duller based on the quality of the ice.
Oh, okay. So when your skates are duller and sharper, does that impact your motion and movement as a goaltender? Do you have to change, you know, how, I don't know if you're going side to side, post to post. I have never played goal. I have no idea. So how much of a difference was it?
Well, for me, I wanted to replicate or have the same sort of resistance on any of my laterals, any of my shuffles that I could possibly have. So on the soft ice with dull blades that dig in really fast, I could get my laterals at relatively similar to the hard ice where you need a little bit more bite on your edge. So I tried to make it the same, whether it was soft ice or hard ice. I tried to have the same sort of push and dig in and the same sort of resistance as I shuffled.
Andy Moog joined us. Andy, we had Grant Ledyard on. He was quite funny. He joked, said, yeah, whatever, you just don't ask me about Marchand blowing by me, ha, ha, ha. But, you know, Todd Marchand, he rarely scored on breakaways, and he came on here and said it himself. As a goaltender, did you ever, like, when you look back on that one, you'd seen tons of guys on breakaways. Was there anything different that you do, like, compared to a Marchand on a breakaway, compared to a Doug Waite, for instance? Or is there just so little time that you're just, you know, trying to get up square and hope the puck hits you?
Yeah, there's a standard philosophy on a breakaway. I mean, you want to get out, add your depth to your position, and just match the speed of the attacking player. You want to mirror that speed. And I would say that it was hard for me to match the speed of a kid that was just shot out of a cannon. That was my greatest challenge, is it trying to keep up with the speed. And as a result, I got a head start on my speed. I started to retreat sooner, knowing the type of speed that he was bringing at me. And when the puck was released, I was probably 12 inches too deep. You know, and the difference would have been I should have had my heels on the top of the paint and I had my toes on the top of the paint. That's just about the difference, and that would have given me, you know, 20% net, less net to cover, and my movement would have been much shorter to arrive and touch that puck, and I just got caught deep on it because of his speed, and he beat me far post with the shot he should have taken because I was retreating.
And I love that description, Andy. Just, you know, the small little technical differences, you know, and how you have to gauge the speed of all the skaters. And so, you know, that's fantastic. I love that. What, I don't know if I've asked any of the guys over the last few weeks about this. What was the message from Hitchcock in the room after game 7 when you lost?
I'm probably going to miss most of it. It was short. Let's put it that way. It was very short. I mean, he took it as hard as anybody in the organization. And there was some sort of frustrating and encouraging note he gave us. But I don't remember being significant in terms of a monologue. I think it was brief. It was filled with frustration. And then some sort of little optimism as we, you know, get out of this season and look for the next season sort of thing. But it was, you know, Hitch took it real hard, and that's, you know, as you related to my history in Edmonton, Hitch's was much longer than mine. And it was bittersweet for him to go against Sather and the Oilers and lose. Hitch had been probably making game plans to beat the Oilers for a long time.
Yeah, that's fair. You've obviously endured some tough losses, some great wins in your career. And when I look back, you know, remember that 86 team, the Game 7 loss against the Flames, and I'm guessing the Stanley Cup Finals obviously would be more heartbreaking. But at the moment, when you lose, you know, you had a lot of experience. When you lose a Game 7, are you as devastated then in that loss after Dallas as you were in those other ones, or just because it wasn't the Stanley Cup final, or, you know, it wasn't in the midst of a having won back-to-back Stanley Cups, it's just less painful?
I don't know if the experience allows you to analyze on the fly better, and you sort of add it up a little quicker as you played a little longer. I think when you're younger, it takes a lot longer to process it out, figure it out, why you won, why you lost. And maybe that's why it's so much more emotional attachment to victories when you're younger, is because you can't figure out why you did it. You just know you did it. And as you play a little while, you start to appreciate more of the subtleties of the game. And maybe in the end, you've got the Game 7, but you understand what's going on in the series, how you're going to have to win the series, and I don't know if that helps or not, but I think you've had more experiences to be able to process the highs and lows of a career.
Well, Andy, you had a fantastic career, an unbelievable career. What are you doing now? Other than, I guess, social distancing right now, but what are you doing outside of that?
Well, I spent the last 4 years in the Western League with the Winterhawks out there in Portland. I've helped them with their goalies for the last 4 seasons, and it's been one of the real highlights of my coaching career is to get close and get associated and help these young teenagers, these under 20s who are aspiring to be pros in their future. So I've really enjoyed it. I've had the three number ones I've had. I've got two NHL contracts and an overage that moved on to Victoria this year, Shane Farkas, who could argue have been top three guys in the Western League before it all ended. So, I mean, I'm proud of the contributions I've given to Portland, and I really enjoy that organization.
Well, Andy, great to catch up with you. Thanks so much for your time. Stay safe, and hopefully the WHL and everybody, just like the NHL, is back up and running in September.
Well, you're welcome. You guys stay safe, too.